Registration is now open on What's-Her-Name's Yucatan Tour 2024. Join us in Mexico as we walk in the footsteps of Zazzle Ha, learn traditional Mayan cooking, tour Mayan ruins, snorkel with sea turtles, and so many more off-the-beaten-track adventures with our wonderful little band of kindred spirits. Spots are going fast, so sign up now on our website at whatshernamepodcast.com. We can't wait to see you there.
This episode was sponsored by our patrons: Bree Ames Smith, Eugene Lewis, Eric and Carolyn Shumway, Robin Brown, Skylar Collins, Julie Gray, Janelise Cannon, Jamie Lang, Maria Sanchez, Valerie Jacobson, Jill Harrigan, Heather McKinnon, Chantel Oliver, and Caitlin McTaggart. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month to help us make more episodes happen. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast. We couldn't do it without you. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, Katie.
Let's start with a newsreel. Ba-ba-ba-ba!
San Francisco Times, June 7th, 1867. An intrepid woman, a perilous position. Yesterday afternoon, the schooner Sea Nymph, Captain Fake, arrived in port and reported having spoken to the ship Ellen Southard from Hong Kong. The Ellen Southard was flying a flag of distress, and it was discovered that Captain Howe, her master, had died on the 6th of May, and the vessel was in charge of his wife. The Ellen Southard is 67 days from her port clearance, by no means a long passage, but the passengers have for some time been on a short allowance of water. There were 400 Chinamen aboard, and these had threatened to murder the crew as soon as their water, which was only 3 days' supply left, was exhausted. The crew were in a partial state of mutiny, having refused to work unless some competent officer was put in charge of the ship. The position of Mrs. Howe must be a particularly painful one. Deprived suddenly of her husband, and thrown almost entirely upon her own resources, in the middle of the ocean, and with 400 angry passengers aboard, harassed by a refractory crew, she has passed through bitter experiences on that hazardous voyage. The captain's wife sent in a letter by the Sea Nymph requesting the consignees, Low and Co., to dispatch a government cutter or a steam tug to her assistance. But strange to say, no efforts have been made to rescue this brave woman who, in the midst of her own deep afflictions, works night and day against fearful odds to save the ship. The current whereabouts of the vessel are unknown.
What? What?
Now that's a wild story, right?
Yeah.
Who is this unnamed captain's wife? And how did she come to be in such a predicament? Let's find out. I'm Katie Nelson.
And I'm Olivia Mickle.
And this is What's Her Name?
Fascinating women you've never heard of.
Catherine Howe, best-selling author and historian, wrote a book about pirates.
Yay!
Of course, I came to find Catherine Howe through her book about witches for our What's Her Name New England tour when I read her Physic Book of Deliverance Dane. Loved it. But now she's actually written a couple books about pirates. One historical fiction, which we're talking about today, and The Penguin Book of Pirates, which is coming out in April.
Cool.
So here is my copy of her latest book. Can you hear it? A True Account, Hannah Missouri's Sojourn Amongst the Pirates, written by herself.
Cool.
It is a swashbuckling adventure from start to finish. I absolutely loved it.
Hello, my name is Catherine Howe, and I'm so excited to be talking with you about my new novel, which is A True Account, Hannah Missouri's Sojourn Amongst the Pirates, written by herself. The action in A True Account opens in Boston in 1726 in the summer, and a teenage girl named Hannah Missouri gets caught up in some intrigue and has to flee Boston for her life. And the way that she does this is by disguising herself as a cabin boy and shipping out on what she thinks is a fruit packet bound for the Azores. But instead, she quickly discovers that she has delivered herself into the hands of some pirates who were confederates of William Fly. And the central question is Hannah's true account really true? And I have a lot of fun with some kind of common tropes about pirate literature and pirate fiction. So Hannah is very much engaging with, you know, Treasure Island type narrative tropes. And I also am able to have some fun as a person who comes from a history background. I am able to have some fun with the trustworthiness of fictional narratives. And can something be, you know, emotionally true while being factually false?
Now, the character Hannah Missouri was named after a relative of Catherine Howe, Hannah Missouri Howe, who in the 1860s sailed away on a truly amazing voyage around Cape Horn, up and down and around the Pacific Ocean for years. And in this episode, we are going to track down her movements.
Yay!
All the way to the mutiny at the end. And even though her story's pretty epic, Hannah Missouri was forgotten in history. And I guess most of us will be forgotten in history. We've talked about this in previous episodes before, you know? How do you get remembered?
Yeah. You have children or you have a champion who makes it their business to make sure you're remembered.
Yes. And you have to leave letters or journals or whatever mm-hmm. for those children to preserve. It appears she did not do any of those things. Mm-hmm. So what we have of her life are some dates and we have a gravestone. To illustrate my point, here is a summary of her life from the genealogy website FamilySearch.org. It's an automatically generated summary of her life, but it's based on the known details, okay? Hannah Augusta Missouri was born on 28th February 1834 in Beverly, Massachusetts, United States. She married Edward Grant Howe on 5th March 1857. She died 23rd February 1910 in Beverly, Massachusetts at the age of 75 and was buried in Beverly, Massachusetts, United States. That's it.
Yep.
That's her life. But we know that everybody's real life isn't that vacuous. And sometimes, if we're trying to unearth the story of somebody, sometimes all we need is a clue, one clue. And in the case of Hannah Missouri, there was a bowl.
But you asked me about the real Hannah Missouri, and she lived later. And I learned of her existence because some years ago, my parents did the great winnowing. You know, I don't know if your parents have done this, where they ship everything to you. And then you have to go through it. Maybe that's just something that my parents did. But there was one day when everything arrived at my home and I had to end up going through it. And I stumbled upon this really beautiful punch bowl. And it had a painting of a square-rigged ship on it. I was like, wow, this is really cool. What's the story here? My parents didn't know. It was like some family piece that had been stuck in a closet forever and ever and ever. And written on it, it said something like, best wishes to Edward Howe, you know, in his endeavors. And I figured out that Edward was like a distant great uncle. And he had been given, the painting of the ship was a clipper ship called the Ellen Southard, which was built in Bath, Maine. And it ended up having kind of a notorious history.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, who is this distant uncle Edward Howe? What is the story of this ship and this bowl? And soon she's uncovering a story of a death on the high seas, mutiny, and its captain's wife who holds the whole thing off with a pistol. Hannah Missouri Howe.
There are a couple of histories of women in maritime communities in the age of sail, and a few of them have chapters about, you know, women disguised as men or prostitutes in waterfront communities or ship captains' wives. And I'd come across a story of a Mrs. Howe who put down this mutiny. But that historian had never found any of the backstory about who Hannah was or where she came from or like what her first name was, and certainly not what had happened to her afterwards.
So the newspapers that are talking about this event and all the other events, they always just mention the captain's wife or they say Mrs. Howe. And this is the kind of vague information that's not helpful at all. Unless you are holding the bowl with the Ellen Southard painted on it and you can connect the dots. The story told to us by this punch bowl is amazing. Hannah was born in Beverly, Massachusetts, as we know, 1834, to Captain Stephen and Sophia Missouri. 2 years later, Sophia died in childbirth. The baby, Stephen Jr., died too. They have a big monument in the cemetery, which I think is like a testament to heartbreak, really. Yeah. Across the street lives the Howe family, another mariner family. and it is headed by Sarah Howe, widow of Dr. Abner Howe, who died of consumption, and she's got 9 kids. She sends her son to sea, like all the men in her family. Mm-hmm. And Edward, when he's just 20 years old, he goes off on a voyage to Africa. And the documentation lists him as, this is their physical description, this is as much as we're going to get, complexion dark, hair black, 5'9" tall. But he is Caucasian, though, according to the census, and so is Hannah. Hmm. Fast forward to 1855, when we have a census that gives us a little picture of their lives. Hannah is 21, and she lives with her sister Harriet, who's 25, and her dad and stepmom. Across the street, Edward Howe is the head of the household at 32, and he's living with his sisters, Emily, who's 36, and Mary, who's 43.
Hmm.
The next year, their brother James was lost at sea on the schooner Hamilton. So, even though they're next door neighbors, it took them a good while to get married. And I'm sure there's a story there. A very Victorian tale.
Yeah.
He's taking care of his spinster sisters or whatever. So we can all fill it in with our imaginations. Eventually, though, they get married 5th of March, 1857.
Hannah Missouri was Edward Howe's wife.
Okay, well then, the big chance. A shipbuilding tycoon in Maine is ready to launch his newly built Ellen Southard, a fully rigged ship. I'll put a painting in the show notes, but these ships carry a lot of cargo and they can sail really fast. The East India Trading Company prefers these kinds of ships. It's 159 feet long. It carries 828 tons, has a 15-man crew, and it's got 3 masts. It's just like your classic, beautiful, giant sailing ship.
And so she was 33 years old, and they had a clipper ship full of locomotives. So when before we started recording, you were telling me that you're in Utah and you are in the place where the railroads met. Well, before the railroads met, they needed to get railroads over to California, and they had to do that with a ship. So Edward left and he took Hannah with him. It took them 207 days to go from Massachusetts all the way down the Atlantic, around the Horn, and up the Pacific coast to California.
And Cape Horn, right there at the tip, is one of the most dangerous places to sail in the entire world. Hmm. I mean, there's so many storms. There's so much good pirate lore, as we know. Like, my favorite is that pirate earrings, those are a social code. You are only allowed to wear an earring if you have sailed around the Cape Horn. And you put the earring in the ear that was facing the Cape, so they know if you went east to west or west to east. The most difficult journey of all is east to west, because the prevailing winds are against you. Those storms are brutal. And they've got a shipload of locomotives trying to get around Cape Horn.
Not heavy at all.
So already I'm a sailor. It's my only hobby. Already I'm just gobsmacked that this woman has been around the Horn, hard sailing upwind in the Southern Ocean with a ship full of locomotives.
Southern tip of South America is notoriously perilous, and prevailing winds blow hard against California-bound vessels. In rounding the Horn, ships report mountainous seas, icebergs, snow, and hail. The vessel Hayes broke both her rudder and stern on icebergs. The Cutwater endured 40 days of successive westerly gales near the Cape, which rent sails, carried away spars, crushed boats, and filled the cabin with water. Sailors on Intrepid suffered frostbite, and the deck and rigging of Golden Fleece was encased in ice. Winged Racer, carrying the first locomotive for the Sacramento Railroad, lost a man overboard, and sailors were blown from the rigging of Sea Lark and Lawrence. All of these accidents occur because of the infamous storms of the Cape Horn, where rescue is impossible.
Of those 207 days, 50 of them were spent just trying to get around the Horn.
Another captain, sailing through the storms, reported to the newspaper that he had sighted Captain Howe's ship in the middle of the storms.
Wow.
And then they get to California. They offload them.
Now, they've got a nice fast cargo ship on the west coast of America. And you know what's in demand, someone says? Oregon pine lumber is really popular in Australia. Would you like to take a load down under?
Sure. Sure. That's easy.
It's only the other corner of the Pacific Ocean. Yeah, fine.
No problem.
Then they zip across the Pacific down to Sydney, Australia.
On rare occasions, we have surviving ship manifests, and we can see that the Ellen Southard is often carrying passengers that include entire families, like wives and children. Hmm. They have passengers that are traveling in cabins and those that are traveling in steerage. So you still got your nice class divide.
Someone had put on the Wikipedia page about the Ellen Southard that include like a manifest that show Edward as the captain and then the list of passengers, and down here tucked in the corner is captain's wife.
Isn't that unusual though? If presumably this is the Western world where women on board are unacceptable, or maybe that's
apparently
more...
not by the time you get to the mid-1800s.
I don't know that I could tell you statistics on it, but it wasn't that unusual in the merchant marine in the 19th century for captains' wives to go with them. It wasn't unheard of. I think it was more unusual on like a whaler, which would be many, many, many years. You know, there's been some histories of like whalers' wives on Nantucket and the culture that they kind of established in such long, often unknown periods of waiting.
And at least we know on the way to California, we know what the crew was. The crew was all American, except the steward was from Portugal and the cook was from Holstein, Germany.
Hmm. Maybe he was just a much better cook. I mean, I'll take German food over 1800s American food.
Thus begins Hannah Missouri Howe's adventures in the Pacific, which she will crisscross every which way over the next 2 years. And this is no, like, safe, secure venture. This is the wildest, deepest ocean on Earth. I mean, if you took all the world's continents and joined them together, the Pacific Ocean would double that. That's how vast it is. It's an ocean world.
I saw an amazing topographical globe the other day that is the Earth with no water. And it is astounding how much deeper the Pacific Ocean is than anything else. I mean, it's like everything else is, you know, this little tiny indentation. And then there's this massive gap of just... I knew intellectually that it was that, but it was really astounding to see it, what it actually looks like.
Only in researching pirates have I even like begun to conceive of how huge the ocean actually is and how unpoliceable it is because of that. So when they landed in Sydney, March 27th, 1865, they brought with them newspapers from the United States from when they left, which was January. So the news was 3 months old, but that was the fastest it could get there, and Sydney was so excited.
Sydney Herald, March 27th, 1865. News from America. Through the courtesy of Captain Howe of the Ellen Southard, we have California papers to the 22nd of January and telegraphic news from New York to the 21st. Our summary follows. The Daily Alta California remarks that Civil War peace rumors still continue to burden the telegraph. Jeff Davis and the rebel junta are at loggerheads. The latter has given an indication of a wish for the appointment of peace commissioners. Jeff Davis is said to be opposed to any movement.
And now Hannah Missouri is going to explore Oceania. And we can track her through the newspapers because they record the arrival and departure of ships. Mm. And sometimes, if we're lucky, they even tell us what their cargo is.
New Zealand Herald, April 8th, 1865. Shipping news. Arrived. The Ellen Southard, bound to Adelaide, called here for orders. Her cargo consists of 588,259 feet of lumber. Otago Daily Times, June 16, 1865, shipping news. Arrived, young lady from Brisbane. Sailed Ellen Salford for New Caledonia.
Now that's a good 8 months sailing around Oceania. Time for something a little bolder.
The Empire Sydney, November 21st, 1865. Projected departures, November 29th. Wild Wave, brig, for Wellington. Lady Bowen, steamer, for Brisbane. Ellen Salford, ship, for Petropavlovsk.
Wow.
That's
Russia?
The city of Peter and Paul in Siberia.
Wow.
It's November.
Oh, yeah. Good timing. Super.
Yes.
Super great idea.
Exactly. That's wonder. Yes. Let's go to Siberia in November.
In November.
It's the snowiest month. It's windy all the time. It's summer in Australia. Mm. Maybe they were like sick of the heat.
Wow.
I don't know. But okay, Hannah and Edward, do your thing. Go for it. In looking at the map, they are sailing past China. And in that moment, China is in the midst of a horrific civil war. The Taiping Kingdom of Heavenly Peace is in the process of being stamped out. It's the bloodiest civil war in the history of the world. And they are sailing past all of that in South China. Then they sail past Japan, which just 10 years earlier, Commodore Perry's infamous black ships had rolled up into Japanese port at Edo and demanded entry. So Japan was westernizing as fast as humanly possible to resist colonization, much to the dismay of samurai everywhere.
Like I think I've read about that in this book that's called The Book of Sisters that I recently read.
You're right.
Who wrote that? I don't remember.
The Nakano sisters, they are preparing to make their last stand as samurai, rebelling against the westernization of Japan. So
I feel like the Taiping Kingdom of Heavenly Peace makes an appearance in some other book by those same authors that might be coming out in a few months. Maybe I'm making that up.
All these stories will make an appearance in a forthcoming History of the World in 80 Lost Women.
Hmm.
Yes. So when I made those connections and I was looking at the map, where are they sailing? Okay, well, what time period is it? Oh, my.
Yeah, just.
No wonder they didn't stop.
Yeah.
I wouldn't stop. And actually, they're not allowed to stop. Those ports were closed to them. But what's open is Russia. So there they are.
As far away as you could humanly get from New Zealand.
Exactly. I was like, why are they going to Siberia? What is up there? Like, maybe they're delivering foodstuffs to Siberia. Mm. Like they did deliver a lot of wheat to different places.
Yeah.
And actually, I really like to imagine her in all of these harbors, like stepping out onto land and exploring each new world. Tropical islands to Siberia in winter. And this port town at the time was really small, rustic, mining town. They traded in furs, fish, silver, and gold.
Yeah.
So maybe they're getting some of all of that. I don't know. But looming over the town are two gigantic snow-capped live volcanoes. It's an extremely inhospitable place. To have seen it, though. Wow. To next?
Well, I mean, what's the other furthest that we could possibly go?
Precisely. You're thinking exactly like the Howes were thinking. How about we go to Talcahuano, Chile?
Let's go there. Yeah, of course.
Literally, like, diagonally, the other end of the Pacific.
Yeah, as one does.
Sydney Morning Herald, July 7th, 1866. The Ellen Salvage, ship 828 tons, Captain Howe, from Talcahuano, Chile, arrived this evening bringing 7,000 bags of wheat, 7,000 bags of flour, Wilkinson Brothers, and co-agents.
No sooner are they back from Chile, unloading and selling their cargo, than they plan their next venture. I can imagine them, like, sitting in a tavern having a conversation, you know, like, what's the next cash crop? Where's the money to be found? And someone says, you know where there are tons of passengers desperate for a ride? China. The biggest civil war in the history of the world. That's beyond any normal human scale. And you know what they all want? They all want a ride to California.
But so, you're not allowed.
And you're not allowed into the Chinese ports.
Yeah, at all.
So, like, yeah, this is like money to be made if you can finagle it. Luckily, the handy British, they've built this global empire and they have claimed Hong Kong for themselves. So all you got to do is roll up to Hong Kong. The Chinese laborers get themselves to Hong Kong. We got a lovely booming port there open to the West. So off to Hong Kong.
Sydney Morning Herald, August 27th, 1866. Projected departures, Ellen Salford, ship 828 tons, Captain Howe for Hong Kong. Passengers, Mrs. Howe, Mrs. Godfrey, and Mr. J. Smedley.
They go up to Hong Kong. Then they pick up a load of Chinese laborers who are going to go work in California. On their way, halfway across the Pacific, Edward died, leaving Hannah in charge of the ship.
That leaves her captain of the ship.
I mean, it doesn't, though. That's a choice that people made, because...
Yeah, who made it?
It doesn't leave your wife captain of the ship. That's not how that works.
Yeah, like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
Did he name her captain? I mean, he's got his first mate and second.
Yeah,
like,
there's,
he's got
there's
his
a
crew.
System to these yeah. things.
According to one source, they picked up a foreign crew. Whatever that means. I don't know. We don't have any information about the crew or who it was. But when he died, she took charge of the ship.
Well.
What do you think? Give me theories. Well, what do you got?
I mean, the fact that they are suddenly disposing of apparently a crew that they must have had a crew and are
yes.
picking up a new one.
Yes.
The kinds of crews that tend to be picked up in random locations and choose their own leader tend to be pirate crews.
Ooh. Everything about it is weird. And then, smack in the middle of the Pacific, Edward just up and dies on her. Ugh! I'd be so mad. We have no details of what he died of or any of those circumstances, so we can weave a yarn to our heart's content.
And they were also starting to run low on fresh water.
That makes no sense. They should not be running out of water. Something catastrophic happened, whether intentional sabotage or terrible mistake.
And so the crew and the passengers staged a mutiny. Hannah put down with a pistol and then signaled her distress by hanging a flag upside down off the stern of the Ellen Southard.
And for some reason, this mutinous crew is refusing to sail the ship into San Francisco. So they're so close. They're like in the Bay of Santa Cruz. And she is sailing the ship by herself. What?
I know. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around, isn't it?
How does this go down?
And here I get so proud of myself when I single hand like 2 hours from Salem to Marblehead and back. And then I come home feeling all smug and independent. Like,
does someone go get them eventually?
So after 3 days, someone goes to get them.
21st, 1867. A heroic woman. The ship Ellen Southard has arrived in port. Mrs. Howe, with her crew in a partial state of mutiny, worked tirelessly for 3 days to save the ship until finally the United States government sent out the Wayanda in search of her. The search finally succeeded in finding her in the Bay of Santa Cruz, where she had drifted. Mrs. Howe was a good sailor, and she worked the vessel well. She stood her watch, though the Chinaman was so brutal she was obliged to carry a revolver in her hand at all times. The crew was picked up in a foreign port, they say, with the Chinaman, made threats against Mrs. Howe's life if she did not get the ship into San Francisco Bay by a certain time. At last, completely worn out, Mrs. Howe was prostrated and confined to her bed. She said that if she had been able to go on deck, the vessel would not have drifted so far to the leeward. The captain of the Wayanda says that he never listened to a more heart-rending tale than that of Mrs. Howe, and he could not restrain his tears when she recounted her trials.
That seems like she's pretty bold. I mean, she's apparently making a choice not to just go get me out of here.
And yeah.
She's
yes,
saying,
exactly.
Absolutely not. This is my ship and I'm in
this
charge.
This is my ship.
And
yes.
We will all die before I give
yes.
up.
Because, you know, what's at stake for her is her husband's share in 3 years of the profits of that ship. Like, his take from all of it, that's what's at stake. And she knows if she leaves, like, she walks away with nothing.
Yeah, literally nothing, and she dies a pauper.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I know. And just thinking about, in that moment, how much they have survived, how many storms they already weathered, all the impossible journeys they survived, only for him to die on the way to San Francisco. Oh, what a story.
Then she sues for Edward's percentage of the ship.
Now, this may perhaps come as no surprise, but the owners of the ship did not want to give Mrs. Howe her husband's cut from the last 3 years of sailing. There they were, back comfortably in their seats in Maine, having never risked life or limb. But she's a woman. We don't want to give it to her. So she had to sue, and she won.
Wow.
And then the timing of it is so crazy, because that was 1867.
The Age of Sail actually officially ended in 1868 with the opening of the Suez Canal. So this is really the very end of kind of the great sailing ship days.
Nobody ever has to go all the way down and around the Cape Horn anymore.
Yeah.
And then the next year after that, 1869, the Transcontinental Railroad is complete.
Yep.
Thanks in part to the locomotives she delivered.
Yeah.
So now people can get from coast to coast without a boat.
And the human labor that she delivered.
Yes. The world has drastically changed. And she was a huge part of
wow.
it. She lived the last 3 years of the Age of Sail, and boy, did she live it up. She went, she sailed everywhere.
Yeah, that, I mean, wow. Were the newspapers not, like, writing about all of this indeed, you know, like, they're, oh, there's a mutiny, but weren't they saying, here's what happened, and we brought her in? Like, that's got to be the biggest story.
No, that's what's so annoying. They're only like, there's a ship off the coast, and it's in distress, and then we hear nothing else.
It was hushed up.
Ooh. For some reason, I was assuming it's common enough that it's just like every few days, here's another ship with a weird thing.
But a mutiny against a female captain? That's news of the year.
Well, you know what? In 1869, there was a writer who agreed with you and said, why is nobody talking about the women in this story?
Yeah.
And they actually wrote about it. Catherine Howe found it. And it is such a layered and fascinating read. Would you like to hear it?
I would.
Okie dokie. Here we go. This is in The Land We Love, Volume 6, Number 4, from February 1869. Women and the Lives of Women. How often we hear of women's vanity, her love of jewels and gaudy attire. It is not alone among Frenchmen, crabbed and cynical, that women are thought devoted to dress and display. Yet how much of thought and time did Prince Esterhazy spend upon his famous diamond plume? His passion for diamonds and jewels was intense, and we know but little of him beyond his jewels. But we have yet to learn that the brilliant gleam of diamonds on the stately brow of Maria Theresa of Austria cost her a thought or weakened the courage of her brave and warlike brain. Dr. Johnson, a name which should be high authority with the gentlemen of our day, speaks of Flora MacDonald as a name that will be mentioned in history, and if courage and fidelity be virtues, mentioned with honor. Has the day arrived when courage and fidelity have ceased to be virtues? The heroic Mrs. Howe has received nothing but a passing notice, while lesser deeds have had golden medals struck in commemoration. We are told that the ship Ellen Southard arrived at the port of San Francisco. A schooner discovered her 80 miles out at sea and flying a flag of distress. On going to her assistance, she was found in command of Mrs. Howe, widow of the captain who had died when the vessel was but a few days out from Hong Kong. The ship was short of water, and the crew and Chinamen, sick, in a state of mutiny. Mrs. Howe sent a message to the consignees to send a tug out to tow the ship into port, but no efforts were made to rescue this brave woman. And in her peril, with the mutinous crew around her, the ship drifted on in the Bay of Santa Cruz. Worn out with watching over her husband's deathbed, and in her deep affliction, she had still taken charge of the ship and worked night and day to save it. Now her life was threatened by the mutineers, and she was obliged to stand her watch with a revolver in her hand. She was found by the United States ship Wyanda, and the officer was melted to tears as he heard of her trials and witnessed her complete prostration as she gave up her post. She did her duty, as every true woman will do, finding her responsibilities and good works where her hands labor, and not always in society, not always with her books, and not always in her kitchen, but with an oversight of her entire household, to be much and often with her husband, sharing his thoughts, his cares and pleasures in a true companionship, and often with her children, seeing with a keen eye that needful wants are supplied, physical and mental, thus giving to husband and children all her advantages of culture and education, talking with them upon history and science, diluted and simplified for the children, and presented with a charm which hovers around a woman of culture and intuition, so that the words will dwell in their young minds, and there be formed a desire for information that welcomes each study with eagerness as it is presented in after life. The passage, it's strange, the passage ends, "Those without the binding tie of wife and mother should read and study much. Even the school books, which are thrown by, could be reviewed. I would have them go much into the society of trained and cultivated minds, remembering always that light words without the sparkle of thought are worthless and sometimes dangerous, and that actions which are wanting in the subtile and delicate grace which appeals to the refined mind are always repulsive, vapid, or trifling. Men do not think it best for us to vote. Whether it be best for society and our country, I cannot yet see clearly. Time will evolve the problem. But this we know, it is best for American women to be clothed with honor and dignity by our public men, and it is not best to rend from true womanhood its purity and pride, presenting it ghastly in faults and defects, and calling an indignant blush to the cheek of every true American, causing the foreigner to smile derisively and say, 'Women are all alike.'" This is the most 19th century thing I've ever heard in my life. It's fascinating.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, but this is just proof that women are divine domestic beings, and this one,
yes, here
one-off
for
thing.
Our moral improvement of yes. everyone else.
Aren't we all? Aren't we all? Don't we exist primarily for the moral uplift of other Americans? But also, it doesn't say her name, right? It doesn't say her first name. It doesn't give us any context. Like, Hannah's still alive. She's like 36 years old. So it doesn't say anything about how she ended up, like where she got, how she got home, or what happened. It doesn't give us a whole lot of detail.
Okay, but here's a kind of meta question that I got thinking after. What that book was trying to do was put the women back in history and then draw conclusions from it.
Wait a minute! Like, talking about fascinating women that nobody's heard of?
That nobody's ever heard of? Uh-huh, yes. And then, you know...
Moralizing about them?
Moralizing about them, yes. Yes, yes. So I've been having a fascinating conversation with myself about future scholars studying episodes of What's Her Name podcast and saying, oh, look at this 21st century interpretation of women from the past.
This is amazing. The most 2020s thing I've ever read in my life.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Amazing. So cool. I mean, I'm glad. We are absolutely a product of our time.
Oh, certainly.
We can't not be. And I actually, I would love to hear future historians' critiques of my worldview that I can't climb out of.
Yeah.
Like, we are our time. Amazing. So her story, I mean, it has such a quiet conclusion.
And so I think that she made her way back. I don't know, actually. I don't know if she made her way back over land or if she went as a passage on another ship. She was probably... if I were her, I would have been a little bit done with sailing at that point, don't you think?
Yeah, take your train that you brought.
Yes, but it's not connected yet. So she either has to wait for the Transcontinental Railroad to be finished, which would zip her right back, or she goes through the Suez Canal. But that would involve boats again. You know, no, we don't know. I would love to know. If she wants to go home, how is she going to get there?
Yeah.
The 1870 census tells us that she had $5,000 in assets.
Wow.
And at that time, that would mean something like $120,000 cash. Or in assets instead, it would probably equate to like $1 million in real estate.
Wow.
So basically, if she lives really simply, she's probably set for life.
Yeah.
But she married a respectable widower dentist and never appeared in the newspapers ever again.
She goes back to Beverly, Massachusetts, buys her own house, and then remarries a dentist and lives quietly until 1910. And I just loved thinking about this woman who had been around the Horn, had crisscrossed the Pacific Ocean, had put a mutiny down by herself, and then refused to let the syndicate cheat her out of what she was owed. And then I also loved imagining, like, imagine walking down the street of Beverly in, like, 1909, and this little Yankee lady is walking by with her market basket or whatever, and she's had this crazy experience and nobody knows it.
8 years later, while she's living her quiet middle-class life in New England, the news of the wreck of the Ellen Southard explodes all over the world.
The Ellen Southard, the ship itself, became a little bit notorious in maritime history because it was wrecked off of the UK. And it was a first instance of a coordinated lifeboat rescue.
It was caught in a storm just outside Liverpool and dashed to pieces.
Wow.
The captain and his wife and children, I think, were all aboard.
Wow.
So I think it must have been amazing to her. Like, wait, but that's my boat.
Yeah.
Like, they were the initial crew.
Yeah.
But the reason that it was all over the newspapers is because U.S. Congress actually changed its laws regarding honor medals so that they could award medals to all the lifeboat rescuers, even though they were British. There was like 50 of them that got these gold medals to honor their rescue efforts.
Cool.
Amazing.
And as far as I could ascertain, Hannah, I don't think ever had any children. And then I figured out where her house was. And I discovered that whenever I would drive into Beverly's not that far from where I live, there's a Mexican restaurant that we like to go to. And whenever I'd go to this Mexican restaurant, we'd park in front of her house. And it's like not a fancy house at all. It's nothing that you would ever like look twice at. And I just loved it. And I thought, wow, this is an incredible story. I loved it so much that I felt like I had to use Hannah's name. And so that's why the character in A True Account is named Hannah Missouri.
She was buried with her dentist husband in Beverly Cemetery.
She was old. She was in her 70s. I mean, she died in 1910. I did hunt down, normally this is not something I would do, but I did hunt down where she was buried. She's in Beverly Central Cemetery and she's with her second husband. And I went and paid a call on her. Because I don't think she ever had any children. And so I thought, you know, I will just go because I know what she did. I know what happened, and that's an amazing story.
So, thank goodness for the bowl with the Ellen Southard on it, right?
It was Edward's, but then it must have been hers. But then I think maybe it ended up being somehow given to Edward's brother, because I'm descended from Edward's brother. Edward's brother, Octavius, was also a ship captain, lived across the street from Hannah. And so I think that's how it somehow wended its way to the shelf in my dining room. I like to write historical fiction about regular people. That is my thing. I personally am much more motivated by people like Hannah Missouri, either the fictional Hannah Missouri that I've invented or the actual Hannah Missouri that we've been talking about. People who otherwise don't leave a lot of record of themselves. And, or, you know, we get like maybe a little bit of material culture here or there. We get some kind of glancing mention in some kind of source, but there's no like relentless documentation. There's no breathless reportage. And I feel like the opportunity of historical fiction is to give ourselves license to imagine into these otherwise overwritten lives. I am so much more moved by the idea of the stories we will never know. And those are stories of regular people, you know. She's not a hero. She's not famous. She even in her lifetime, she is forgotten, essentially. You know, she is middle class at best. You know, she's not rich. She's not influential. She doesn't have she doesn't know the famous people of her day. She's not hobnobbing with Oliver Wendell Jones or, you know, any of these things. I will say that there's something amazing to not letting yourself be defeated by incredibly adverse circumstances. To face down, I think all of us at certain points in our lives have to face down things that terrify us, whether that is, you know, something in our personal health, whether that is something global, whether that is, you know, I think that definition, the definition of the terrible will change from person to person. But I think, unfortunately, I think there is no human life that is untouched by terror in some regard. And so I like to think about her being unbent by this confrontation of this terrible experience. I don't think it's necessary to hold her up the way that that passage does, you know, as like some kind of paragon of nobility and virtue. I think she was probably very desperate. I think she was probably frightened. I think she was probably angry. I think she was probably exhausted, you know. I don't think that we need to sanctify her in order to see the value and the courage in what she did. And so I would conclude that to like allow ourselves our humanity and our frailty when we face down whatever it is, the terrible thing is that comes to us in our life. It didn't make her famous. She doesn't have, you know, her painting in the Boston Athenaeum or any of that stuff. She's not even really mentioned in like obscure maritime societies that were still active at that time. And yet she did this incredible heroic thing, this astonishing thing.
Special thanks to author Catherine Howe for bringing us the story of Hannah Missouri Howe. You can find her new book, A True Account, Hannah Missouri's Sojourn Amongst the Pirates, written by herself, on our website, whatshernamepodcast.com. If you'd like to see our animated map of the journey of Hannah Masuri, head to our website, whatshernamepodcast.com, or to the show notes. Music for this episode was composed by Isabella and Violetta Parra, Elephant, Jesse Gallagher, Emmett Fenn, Chris Hagen, The Royal Vagabonds, Jeff Kuno, Kevin McLeod, Doug Maxwell, and Daniel Foster Smith. Thank you for donating. Thanks for listening.